I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the London Review Bookshop podcast. To find out about our upcoming events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.
Hi, everyone. I think we're live now. Irenison, can you hear me properly?
I can. Can you hear me?
Oh, that's good.
That's so helpful. You look great. It's great, by the way.
So to begin with, thank you so much for doing this with me. I said it a thousand times, but it's such a pleasure to have you. Thanks to the London Review of Bookshop, London Review Bookshop for having us, and thanks to all of you guys for attending this. So this is one of the main events I'm doing to launch my new book. It's called Sterling Karat Gold, but this is not the sole focus of this chat, because obviously I've got Irenison Okojie, and this is her last publication. So we will talk about both of these books during this chat today, and it's going to be really quite relaxed, and you guys can chip in with questions at any time, and we'll just either address them towards the end or on the spot. Let's just see how it goes. Do you think?
Yeah, sounds great. And thank you so much for inviting me to be a part of this event. It's such a joy, actually, to do this conversation with you, because you're such a joy and such a brilliant writer, and, you know, somebody who whose journey I've watched, as you know, and I'm just thrilled for you, you know, that you have this excellent, amazing book out. So, yeah, I'm really happy for us to have this conversation.
And I know it's so rare for us, right, to get to talk with other writers, like over the last since the pandemic, really. So all of these events are just a total joy, isn't it? And I've been attending lots of online events as well, just to hear people talk about their writing. So it's a treat.
It's a lovely thing, isn't it, to hear other talk about process.
And yeah, no, completely.
So sort of isolated and insular at the moment that it's just like, oh, these things are just really great to have at the moment, you know, to the intimacy of having a one-to-one conversation with another author is a lovely privilege. Yeah,
exactly. I would agree.
Yeah.
So I think everybody in the audience will know who you are anyway, but I will do the proper thing and read your introduction, just in case some people are new to either of our writings. We thought we do the polite thing and don't presume anything. So I'm going to briefly read out. Hey, do you pronounce your own name Irenison or Irenison?
Irenison.
I do.
That's the right way. You've been right all along. Actually.
But so many people, that's how I say it, and so many people say Irenison, but I guess it's like an anglicized version of it.
Yeah, no, it's definitely Irenison.
Perfect. So, Irenison Okojie is a Nigerian-British writer. Her debut novel, Butterfly Fish, won a Betty Trask Award and was shortlisted for an Edinburgh International First Book Award. Her short story collection, Speak Gigantula, published by Chakaranda Books, was shortlisted for the Edgehill Short Story Prize, the Chalak Prize, the Saboteur Awards, and nominated for a Shirley Jackson Award. Her new collection of stories, Nudie Brunch, published by Dialogue Books, was longlisted for the Charlock Prize. She's the winner of the 2020 AKO Kane Prize for Fiction for the absolutely phenomenal short story Grace Jones, which I will point out is available to read for free online somewhere. I know this because I've been teaching that story last term, and the fact that it was available freely online for everybody, easily accessible, was a boon as well. So guys, if you want to check something out, try before you buy, then go and find that short story. And Irene is also a fellow and vice chair of the Royal Society of Literature, and I think recently, and what's it called, an OBE or an MBE?
An MBE, yeah.
I know, with all the complexity, it's just incredible.
Thank you so much. Thank you for that lovely introduction. And now I'm privileged to introduce you. The amazing Isabel Widener is a writer and academic based in London. They are the author of three novels, Sterling Karat Gold, We Are Made of Diamond Stuff, and Gaudy Bubble. They were shortlisted for the Goldsmiths Prize and the Republic of Consciousness Prize twice, amazing, and won the International Literature Press. They are a co-founder of the event series Queers Read This at the Institute of Contemporary Arts and the programmer and presenter of This Isn't a Dream, a fortnightly literary talk show also hosted by the ICA via Instagram Live, which is a fantastic series of events. For those of you who may not be aware of it, you know, definitely want to go back and look at the videos if they're still actually available to consume. But yeah, what a joy to be in conversation.
Exactly. Yeah, guys, exactly. I'm doing this talk show, this regular fortnightly literary chat show with the ICA as well. And Irenison was one of the guests. So go to the ICA IGTV and watch our conversation there as well, if you get into the flavor of things. But this one is quite different because I think we're going to focus. We had a lot. We started the conversation and realized we had a lot to talk about, which is why we're going to pick up. This is going to be an even better part of the conversation.
Part two.
And I will say again that all of our books, including the new ones, published by Peninsula Press and Dialogue Books, are available on the LRB website. There's a particular little link that Claire from the LRB will probably put up in the chat, and you can buy our entire back catalogue on the London Review bookshop website. So, shall I ask you a question first?
Yeah.
So, I wanted to... I did this before when I talked to Irene, and I picked up on particular lines because she is like incredible with lines. There are some lines in, especially Nudie Brunch, I think, which is my personal favorite work of yours so far. And they're just some lines that really make you fall over backwards. So one of my favorite ones is in a short story called Daishuku. And this particular line is about Elephant and Castle, which if you're in London, all of you will know and probably miss already because they've just taken it down, I think, or they're in the process of taking it down. So the line is, the grotesque shopping mall's pink elephant drinking oil from the subway steps before skidding on the ice, breaking its neck to interrupt the overwhelming feeling of loneliness. So you take this little pink elephant that we all know, that we all seen 1,000 times, and you make it do something, just kind of out of context, but in the story, but really fundamentally rooted in the story as well. And you connect this to this sort of surreal imagery that's also incredibly, incredibly realist, because we're so familiar with this, the elephant, and you make it do something that's to do with something really profound, like human loneliness. And there's so much going on in this line, and it does so much work, and it's at the same time so stunning. Like, I could write an entire novel about this one
No, thank you very much. Yeah, I mean, I think that I really have a passion for creating imagery that's loaded and operating on multiple levels. Because for me, I just have so much to say, and sometimes I find it hard to just say it really cleanly. So it's a bit like falling down a rabbit hole. And you know, I went to college there for a bit, and it was so interesting, that experience, because that the market there, like, everyone will know it, you know, the market there is kind of slightly gauzy and slightly bizarre, and then you have that like weird looking pink elephant, which is almost like, I don't know, slightly saccharine in that very gritty environment, and it kind of throws you off a bit. You know, and there are points where I was, you know, coming back and forth when I was attending college there, that I felt that sense of loneliness, you know, that sense of, I don't know, where you're in the city and so much is happening, but at the same time you can feel quite removed from it while particular images just stay with you. And there was just something about that pink elephant that I felt really works as a kind of anchoring. Oh, that's something that people will recognize from that area, but also, you know, also will be surreal and, you know, make you question your sense of place. You know, it's this thing of presenting place as you know it, where it's familiar but also unfamiliar, in a sense, in that things happen, and often with my stories, things come to life.
That's what I was going to ask.
Yeah,
Exactly.
things come to life. So it's just, it's everything kind of speaks, everything has its own kind of hidden entity about it that's really fascinating for me. So that's, you know, that's why I guess that image operates on that level. I want to ask you similarly. I mean, your work is so daring, exciting, and I think provocative in terms of what you're doing. I want to know, for this novel, because when we last spoke, you said something really interesting to me, which I think is absolutely amazing for a writer and artist to be doing, is that you want to do something different with each book. You know, you want to push yourself, where it's, people know it's Isabel Widener, but they're getting something slightly different. So I wondered if you could just talk to us a bit about, you know, your intentions for this book, and you know, how you feel it's different to the first one, also brilliant, and what you're doing in terms of form, because it's also like, I don't know, I think your stuff is really kaleidoscopic, man. It's like, you
Yeah,
know,
no.
you go into these bizarre worlds with these deeply colorful characters that you really, really care about. You know, you want to see how the story unfolds, and it's kind of like madcap, and it's zany as well. You know, and there's just like this playfulness to it. And I'm just amazed that you do all of that. So yeah, I was curious.
Oh, thank you so
Talk to
much.
us about that. Yeah.
No, I mean that's completely what I'm trying to do in a way. And where shall I start? I mean, exactly. To begin with, how is it different from We Are Made of Diamond stuff? I think sort of some of the themes are still kind of the same, and they probably will always be the same. They're like looking at kind of queer and trans and working class and migrant bodies in this current condition that is the UK that we're all existing in. So it always looks at that. So there is like an element of realism in some bizarre way, really fundamentally in there. But then, like you say, in a way, I also do what you do is I open up these rabbit holes. Like I would have surreal imagery in there as well. I would have like weird imagery of some weird language in there, or something that just veers off at an angle in a way in there suddenly, and it opens up all of these. Actually, I like it, all of these rabbit holes. But I will also say that I think that often also reflects the experience that we have here in this, actually in the UK in particular. That sort of this idea that sometimes you don't know where you're at anymore. I do this deliberately in my writing, but it also reflects some of my own experience sometimes. Even reading the news, you sometimes think, where did that just come from? So I'm doing all that, and I think in terms of the difference to Diamond Staff, I think this book is probably, I don't know whether I want to do something completely different each book, but I want to be a little bit more ambitious with each book.
Yeah.
So I think this achieved, I think I would, if I say so myself, I think I achieved that. That's sort of the I try to do something a little bit more ambitious and a little bit more extra compared to the previous books.
Yeah.
That's maybe as much as I would say.
And
I also, yeah, exactly. I try to create narratives that are actually catchy, which is something that you do as well. You do this sort of what they used to call experimental aesthetic at the same time as actually having quite captivating narratives. And I try to do that too.
I think that's the theme for both of us, actually. And just kind of responding to what you just said, I felt a similar way after Speak Gargantula was such a raw collection for me. I was essentially just making sense of my experience as a young Black woman growing up in London, Nigerian, but also British, but kind of like in between cultures as well. And just like that feeling of being other, you know, so I was just trying to make sense of it with those stories. So it was like there was really no technical like approach in terms of it was just these raw stories that came out of me because I had discovered the form through reading Dennis Johnson's incredible Jesus's Son, which is an amazing short story collection that I credit actually for making me passionate about the short form. And I guess I loved the empathy he was able to create with the character in that series of interconnected stories, because the character was a drug addict and somebody on the fringes, and weirdly enough I connected to that because obviously it was slightly different, the character was a white man, but there was something about the otherness of what he was going through, trying to process being an addict and these colorful characters that would come into his world. And it was such a freewheeling collection that it really kind of struck me. And I thought, God, I would love to do some. I would love to use the short form to express myself in that way. So, yeah, Speak Gargantula, it was just kind of, yeah, getting those experiences out. But having, the ideas were quirky as well. But they were also, some of the things actually happened. Saying that, actually some of the stuff that happens to us is actually real, even though it sounds crazy. And it was like, how do I make sense of this?
This is so interesting, because just to pick up on what you just, the last thing that you just said, it has happened to me before that people, readers couldn't tell, people thought particular elements were surreal and were inventions that I said, oh no, that bit actually happened exactly like that. So it's about blurring these lines a little bit of what is realism, what is real and what is surreal. That I think I'm trying to completely displace that, and I think you do that a little bit too, exactly.
Yeah.
Because,
no, definitely, and yeah, there were one or two stories in Speak Gargantula as well where when people read that, they said, oh God, surely that's not real. Like, you made that, you just made that up from your imagination. And no, that happened.
Yeah.
it actually is true,
Exactly.
And there are some quite fantastical stories, but there were some that actually genuinely happened. And then I think like you as well, I think we have so much in common in terms of our intention. With Nudibranch, I just wanted to be even more ambitious. Like, the ideas were wilder, the ideas were more experimental, the stories were longer than the stories in Speak Gargantula. I was like pushing myself. And I felt, in a sense, I guess because, I'd been picked up by a different publisher in a way that gave me a certain confidence, because with Speak Gargantula, I was like, I wasn't sure how the writing would be received, and then because it was sort of critically acclaimed, that really made me feel like, okay, I can really own being in this place, having these ideas. It's like permission in a way, the same way we get from writers. In fact, I think that's probably what I'm going to ask you next. Who who kind of gave you permission to say, I want to, because I think that's really important. You know, it's a bit like having, I call them literary ancestors, where there are people you just, their work was just so important in helping shape you. Not that you imitate what they do, because obviously, you know, to find your authorial voice, it takes a while to get to that place. But
Exactly.
something about that their work made you feel, oh, I can exist too. I can dare to do things too. So yeah, that's what I want to ask you that. Who did that for you? Because I think that that's important for,
That's a
you know.
really interesting question, and it took me actually ages to find my proper literary ancestors, because there is, especially in Britain, I think I can say that there is actually a shortage of queer innovative writers. Like, there are people working now, but there has been a bit of a desert. Actually, up until the last few years, the idea that there would be queer and formerly innovative writers in the city, based in the UK, it was just not particularly happening, to be completely honest with you. So I felt, because I mean, interestingly, We Are Made of Diamond Stuff isn't even my first novel. My first novel is called Gaudy Bauble. I show you. Is this? So I had this out first.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And
Lovely.
before I had this out, I'd written already like three other novels that never got published. So I've in a way
Wow.
been writing for ages, for like I've probably been writing full time, honestly, for almost 20 years. And there was
Incredible.
so such an absolute absence of a scene, or I should say that if there was a scene, it wasn't accessible to me, because also I was working class, I was working in like other jobs. So it took me, I was writing for a really long time before my work started surfacing. And this is quite typical for lots of for if I speak to other queer writers who were doing like who were writing work that is just didn't map exactly on the kind of more acceptable traditions, more acceptable traditional literary traditions. People were working away for ages and ages and ages till we're like now surfacing. But I did find an American tradition. They're called New Narrative tradition, and they're not even very well known in the UK to this day. They started in the 70s, and they are a collective of queer writers who did really innovative stuff. And started reading that kind of stuff, and that gave me for myself the permission to really be confident. But in a way, I also had to find my confidence just by doing and doing and doing it, and acquiring some sort of a competence, I guess. Like, over the years, you kind of know what it is that you want to do, and that what you're doing is solid or not. So that's how it happened, really. And now there is like a really thriving literary scene of queer poets, and also artists who are writing really innovative stuff. And like trans writers are getting actual publicity. It's a different world, you know.
I think
So
that's great. You know,
yeah.
that's it's really important. And like you said, it's come from a place of like lots of hard work and sort of quiet writing as well for a long time. You know, you talk about, which is why everything that's happening for you is so fantastic, because you have been doing that work for a long time, and it takes a lot to keep going. You know, people often see the work, but they don't understand the cost of what goes on behind the scenes. You know, you would have had to make space for that, juggle multiple jobs, juggle appointments, juggle people who didn't be maybe believe in your voice because they thought it was too much of a risk, and all this sort of stuff that we publish, you know, oh, it's good, but we can't do anything with it. You know, as a writer, all of that has an impact on you, and you kind of have to pick yourself up when that stuff happens and keep going. And I think that what you said is really inspirational, actually, about having to find your confidence yourself. Of course, you have to, you know, you have to read other people's work and be influenced by other writers, but you have to do the work as well. You know, you have to believe you have you. There's something to say to the world, and that deserves the space. You know, even if you can't see much of yourself reflected, and that's how I felt. You know, I felt the same way because
people didn't imagine
me. They did, they didn't really know what to do with me in the beginning because we would send work out and it was like, okay, this is really strong, but we don't have a space for her on our list, or we don't know how we're going to push her or market her. And, you know, that stuff is really disappointing because you feel like you're doing the work, you know. I just had to keep going as well. And was really, I guess, influenced by people like, I mean, I guess some of the usual suspects, Toni Morrison, I've talked about her before. And I actually think that she was experimental, but not really given that credit because everybody talks about her political impact, you know. But also people like Jamaica Kinsid, whose collection at the bottom of the river. It's like, it's not even, I don't even know what to call that. How do you even define that? You know, it's like a series of paintings or, you know, like a series of meditations. I don't know. It's just, it's really weird. And I really love what she did. And then, you know, people like Shirley Jackson as well, who were just quite dark in terms of the things that she would write about. Octavia Butler. I mean, I remember reading Wild Seed and I was like, what the hell? I just read. Oh my God.
Definitely.
This is amazing. You know, but there wasn't really, I guess, a strong UK presence of Black innovative writers, except Bernardine Evaristo and Leonie Ross, whose work I love. I love both of them because, you know, because they exist in that space, it kind of gives you permission to feel like, oh, okay, I can exist in that space too. Yeah, so
definitely.
It's just really interesting.
it's really interesting. And I still feel like that at the moment because there is not that many elders for my generation in terms of like a queer and trans scene. We are still doing a lot of work, not just me, but my peers now as well, a lot of work to create the conditions for our own existence in a way. So we're doing a lot of queers and a lot of work. And part of that is me putting on that event, an event series at the ICA that Queers Read This as well. Part of that was like working with publishers and like sort of some like mentoring or at least supporting upcoming queer and trans writers.
Yeah, so, that's phenomenal. I just think that's so phenomenal to have that generosity of spirit to want to create space for other writers because not everybody does that. You know, I think we're both very community orientated, you know, because we see it as if I create a space to thrive, then others can thrive as well. You know, it's not just about me thriving. Like, I don't enjoy it when it's like that, because as you know, it can be a very isolating, lonely experience. But there's something so rewarding and wonderful about seeing other people thrive and flourish and kind of get their wings as well. So I think it's incredible that you've had that generosity of spirit, and you know, this is how you function as a writer. It's just what you do.
Exactly. I have no interest in being on my own. I almost would say that I almost started writing to find to connect with other writers and to connect with other queer and trans writers. So it was exactly, I wanted to achieve that through writing, only to then realize, oh, okay, that might not, there aren't, at least not in the context that I existed in, there weren't many other writers. There were many artists, many musicians, many people who were studying, I guess, but there weren't many writers in a way in my social environment, really. But now there are, now there's tons.
Now there's loads, right? And that's
exactly.
Really exciting, you know.
It's exciting times for literature at the moment. I mean, maybe the most exciting ones, like since in my lifetime, because this, like it's what's been happening with black writing, it's with queer and trans writing, these things are now suddenly, there's this, they're like, I don't know for what reason, but at the moment there's we have actually managed to create a bit of a space, but it's kind of work.
That's amazing. And yeah, it's so important as well to be able to have the conversation with allies who get that, because of course you wouldn't, if you didn't have an ally at ICA who got what you were trying to do, you know, you wouldn't be able to put on this, that series. So it's about connecting with people who want to be able to give that platform to artists who get it. I'm just glad that like those conversations are obviously happening, and it means that, you know, you continue to create space, you know, space for others.
Shout out to the LRB for giving us.
Shout out to them. Yeah, absolutely.
Hey, shall we do a reading? Because I'm sort of looking at the clock, and if you want to give the audience a chance to ask questions, maybe we should both do short readings.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to and do then, that.
And then like, open it up to the audience.
Well, should start? Do you want you're the headliner, so I think I should go.
there's no headliners in this.
Yeah, you're the headliner, so I'll go first. I'm going to read from Cincipellum, which is a story about a tailor who sets up a shop in a sewing, he sets up an atelier in a sewing machine museum and starts to create dresses for the local women who become infatuated with him, but there is a price to pay. So this is an excerpt from Cincipellum. She began working for him a week later, scouring shops for fine materials, measuring and cutting, learning to sew, hunting for unusual accessories. She visited milliners, procured fine hats the colour of quail eggs, the burnished gold of the Sahara, the hue of the Garonne at night. She watched his sketches come to life with a soft wonder in her throat, the outfits like architectural constructs waiting for bodies to invade them, her fingers spinning them slowly on a tailor's mannequin under the kaleidoscopic glow from the skylight, the quiet language of sand stealthily spilling in a corner, the chug of the sewing machines temporarily silenced. The pop-up atelier in the sewing machine museum sprang up like a small utopia, longing for the flurry of action. And the women came like drunken butterflies drawn to Eden, one by one, until the atelier became a hive of activity, leaking laughter and excitable voices. The women were seduced by Manu, his beauty, his sophistication, the unpredictability of his style, his erudite tales, and the assured rumble of his voice. He told them he was born in the Gambia, Namibia, Zambia. He was inconsistent, flamboyant. Oh, but where was he from again? No matter. He offered them Cincipellum, wild African berries, as if the fruit grew from the blade of the guillotine, the hands of the old grandfather clock on one atelier wall, the mouths of the mannequins, the break of sweet exotic fruit flooded the women's tongues. They kept coming back for more, more Manu, more handfuls of Cincipellum, more Noma, flicking through his sketches, fingering the lines of all they could be, if only, aspiration captured in drawings, all the while kernels of pain formed inside Manu, gathering into a mass. The orders increased. Mrs. Jovan, head of the town council, had a nettle green Boadicea gown made for her, which swished around her ankles romantically. Mrs. Lonergan, owner of a chain of flower stores, cooed in pleasure at the final reveal of her metallic Joan of Arc inspired ensemble on the atelier floor. Mrs. Hunt, a wine buyer, blinked at her image in an intricately designed pale off-shoulder 1920s flapper number with a crystallized beaded beret to match, gasping as if she hadn't seen herself before, at least not this way. Manu made women feel marvelous, valued, appreciated. He not only understood the female form, He celebrated it, every dip of the back, every arch of a neck, every individual flare of hips. He masked and he revealed, he obscured and he unearthed. He knew how to make the most extraordinary of women feel like a goddess. This was his gift. Every woman had a quality of beauty of her own, making, lurking beneath the skin. Manu knew ways to make it bloom, how to tease it to the surface. And every night, Noma would return to her lonely bedsit, bone tired, fall into bed, unceremoniously woken by the leak in her ceiling landing on her face, acting as an alarm for the next day's activities. 5 months passed. The women loved their new outfits. They danced in their hallways wearing them, fun in mirrors gathering mist the colour of cinsepalum. Their reflections were released, mimicking their poses in the poorer areas of town, the other side. A swish of silk skirts passing the window of a Turkish food hall that had shut down. A pantsuit limp against the keyhole of a gutted former Jamaican takeaway. A squeezed flamenco dress sleeve brushing the iron gates of an abandoned youth centre that had lost its funding. Slipstreams followed each reflection like a watery shadow. By June, the shots of pain my new experience had intensified, spreading through his limbs. His hands in particular were in constant pain. He woke up in agony, the fingers appearing gnarled to him. He couldn't keep up with the orders, with the monster he'd created. The rise of sand from the suitcase in the corner of the atelier had become too much. The mannequins were pregnant with mirages, stomachs protruded, splitting material. The glove in the post slot had swelled with blood. Designs from the periphery had begun to crash through the skylight in confused stupors, unsure of how their material versions would manifest. The chug of the sewing machines in his ears was constant, till he found himself impersonating the sound sporadically in conversation. He'd run out of ash, and his wild African berries no longer grew in the area for him. I'll leave it there.
When everyone's on the same page, getting things done at work is easy. No matter what you do or what industry you're in, how you communicate is key. Everything you type is equally important to collaboration, and Grammarly can help. Think of it as your AI writing partner, empowering you to communicate effectively and efficiently so you can make a bigger impact in the workplace. 96% of Grammarly users say it helps them craft more impactful writing. And as the gold standard of responsible AI, Grammarly is your secure AI writing partner that allows your team to make their point and move faster. By understanding your writing in context, Grammarly provides relevant, personalized suggestions. And with tone suggestions, you can navigate even the most difficult work conversations. You can also save time from spending hours editing drafts to just seconds with one click. Sign up and download Grammarly for free at grammarly.com/podcast. That's grammarly.com/podcast. Easier said, done.
Shopify helps you sell at every stage of your business. Like that, let's put it online and see what happens stage.
And the site is live.
That we opened a store and need a fast checkout stage.
Thanks, you're all set.
That count it up and ship it around the globe stage.
This one's going to Thailand.
And that, wait, did we just hit 1 million orders stage? Whatever your stage, businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for your $1 a month trial at shopify.com/listen.
Thank you.
Incredible. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure. Can we have a similar treat from you?
Yeah. Shall we have a something?
Yes, please.
I don't know.
That'd be lovely.
Okay. So because it's a novel, I'm just going to give a tiny little bit of context. This is from the beginning of the second chapter, and you don't need much context. All I'll say is that the main character, Sterling, basically was attacked in the very first scene of the book. They're attacked and it's like some sort of bullfight. So Sterling is attacked by all of these bullfighters. So there's a reference to that in the section that I'm reading. And the other thing you need to know maybe is that that Sterling is rescued by like some other trans person called Rodney, and Sterling immediately like develops some sort of crush on Rodney, but it's sort of unspoken and stuff. And then but mainly what we'll see is an encounter of Sterling with their very, very best mate called Chachki, who they run a performance group with, like some DIY performance troupe. And that's what happened in the first chapter. So I'll just read the second bit. And Sterling is basically now encountering someone who says they're a time traveler. So it's out there, yeah? Okay, I'll start. Having dropped Chachki off at their block, I continue walking up Delancey Street towards mine, and the exact same person, Chachki, or so it seems, who I dropped off seconds ago, is now walking towards me, talking and gesticulating with urgency. Not only is this Chachki so-called, positioned impossibly in relation to where I just left them, they are dressed in an outfit entirely unfamiliar to me, namely a too tight, cheap-looking, two-tone polyester two-piece, second-hand car dealer style, and tassel loafers, which arguably counts as a look somewhere New Jersey. They've got their hair slicked into a center parting and unfairly are showcasing a neatly clipped pencil moustache, the likes of which I've been trying to grow for a decade but haven't been able to, and more to the point, doesn't exist above Chachki's upper lip either, or it didn't seconds ago. And what's that smell? Is that eau de cologne? This Chachki, in that two-tone two-piece, orange or purple depending on the light's angle of incidence, is talking non-stop and inappropriately loudly in an effort to get my attention. But I'm sorry, I'm already listening to the staticky sound that their suit makes in motion, the clicking of their loafers on asphalt, and la 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 la, the singing in my head. And yet I can hear Chachki cheap copy chatting at me, repeatedly saying about an important message they wish to convey, and get this, about the not too distant future, hence they hail. And if there was ever a point where I was following them, I'm now lost, metaphorically speaking. Literally, I just arrived outside my flat. I stop, throw caution to the wind, look pseudo Chachki straight in the eye, and ask, what message? Chachki's secondhand car salesman stresses that under no circumstances should I do what I'm planning on doing tomorrow, Saturday, and that I should put my not unfounded reservations about the police to one side and report what happened to me earlier today as a priority. They're referring to the bullfight, of course. Go police, they say. That is the message. I'm sorry, who are you? I say uncooperatively, and as a rule, I don't take instructions from strangers. But it's me, Chachki, Chachki's center parting insists. And I admit that there's a softness in their eyes that is vaguely familiar, alongside a mercilessness that is irreconcilably alien. It's this mercilessness, this determination, beyond even the suit, the moustache, and the eau de cologne, that renders them unrecognizable to me. I'm telling whoever this is that they aren't Chachki, their blatant inhumaneness being just one of the many, many reasons I know that they aren't Chachki, but an imposter and a charlatan. What's this now? They're pinging unsolicited photos to my phone, depicting me and Chachki in unfamiliar scenarios, one shot against a backdrop mimicking Baghdad, and one featuring ancient superstructures in, where? The Belizean rainforest, Chachki Sosi says. So I say as if and dream on. The furthest I travel is Forest Gate to the east, Forest Hill to the south, Westbourne Park to the west, and Glasgow to the north. I have never been a tourist or a global citizen or part of an international jet set at all. I've stayed put since first I arrived in London in 2001, perhaps to minimize travel costs, perhaps because all I've ever wanted was a home. Photoshopped, I say, disparagingly, also nonchalantly, as if Chachki con artists' photos don't look impressively realistic and aren't getting to me. But they do look realistic and they are getting to me. I start deleting the images as they come in. I can't delete them quickly enough. Trash can, trash can, trash can, waste basket. while Tchatchki perfume counter keeps bombarding me with their unlikely photos and videos. There are short clips of me looking disorientated in San Francisco. Never in my life have I been San Francisco. Are you sure you want to delete? Yes, I am sure. Delete already. But then phony Tchatchki pings over an image of Rodney and myself in a car park outside what looks like a North American mosque, and I hesitate. Not because of North America or the mosque, but because of Rodney, myself, and the unimaginable familiarity existing between us. Tchatchki 4711 now corners me in the entrance to my block, saying, look at me, as if that would change anything. You aren't, Tchatchki, I repeat, like a mantra or a protective spell. I prove to you that I am, they say. And how are you going to do that, I say. They say chariots, Roman spa. Three words, six syllables, denoting the place the real Tchatchki and I met 20 years ago, a life-changing encounter for both of us. We'd be nothing without each other, and neither of us would be anything without cataclysmic foibles, and the latter wouldn't exist if it weren't for Chariot's Roman Spa, the gay sauna in Shoreditch, East London, 1996 to 2016, RIP, old gentrification. Tchatchki Cologne says it again, namely that they, Tchatchki Tesla loafers, are Tchatchki, the only difference being that they went back in time to put me off my ill-fated plans to go Hendon Football Club tomorrow and to urge me to go police ASAP, ideally tonight. Or else, I say, being difficult, I say that I don't remember having informed Tchatchki my bestie nor Tchatchki from the future of the precise nature of my plans. In fact, I kept my messaging deliberately cryptic all day. To prevent unsolicited interventions, I didn't want to be in the position of having to justify or defend my plans to go Hendon tomorrow, not to Tchatchki, nor to them, a cheap alter ego with a pencil moustache. I think I'll leave it at that.
Incredible. You know what? But obviously I read it and it's amazing, but hearing you read it out loud as well, it's just like the world explodes and reconfigures. It's just absolutely, I want to swear. It's brilliant.
Thank you so much.
You create such a singular, unique aesthetic with this character and, like, you know, the intimacy, the way you bring the reader on board to kind of go along in his world and get a sense of what he's going through, and like with these samey contexts as well. I mean, what an opener. It's incredible. That was such a wonderful treat. Thank you for that.
Bless you, it's an honor.
Amazing. Yeah,
absolutely. Hey, shall we have a look, because we've only got 10 minutes left, so
yeah.
Guys, we're going to look at some of your questions, so if you want to get some in, type them into the chat now and I'm going to read them out. So one element of Okoji's work that fascinates me is dreamlike and glitchy plot progressions, whether it is the feverish shards refusing to cohere of speak gigantula or the dizzying historical maelstrom of butterfly fish. I'm curious, how does Okoji consider her work's dizzying discontinuities?
Gosh, what a question. I mean, that's a PhD right there. The only way I can describe it, I guess, is that it's kind of instinctive, because that's how I write. You know, I feel my way through the process, and I like to be surprised myself, because I think that when that happens, it makes it a joyful, unexpected experience for me. You know, I can have an idea one day and then come back to the page the next day, and that idea has mutated slightly by the time I'm writing it, and something else has come up that's taken me off course. And I think, oh, what about putting her in that context? Or what if this happens? Or what if this person just randomly appears? Or what if this what if I just explore this texture, you know? So I think, because I'm so curious myself, and I'm so curious about process and how I keep it elastic, that's so important for me in terms of my approach. You know, some people like to be really structured, and that's fine as well. Everybody is different, but I'm kind of at the opposite end of the spectrum in that. So yeah, I guess like the way things are upended, it's a surprise for me too. It's also partly mysterious is all I can say. You know, I mean, I have an intention, and as I'm creating the texture of a narrative, I'm really into creating the world and what it feels like, and you know, what things look like, and making sure that there are specificities within that, so you get the sense that you're somewhere familiar, but you've also just suddenly fallen down a rabbit hole, and you're somewhere different, you're somewhere other. I think that the otherness that I experience outside in the world, or the restrictions that I feel or experience outside in the world because of who I am as a Black woman, there's something about the freedom on the page that lets me just, you know what I mean, just completely go there. I become completely fearless on the page in a way that the world doesn't allow me to be. And I think that's why the works turn out the way they do, you know?
I completely relate to what you're just saying. That was such a brilliant answer. And something you also said, I would apply to myself as well, that you say, you need to be excited yourself. You need to be surprised and be excited yourself. I have that really a lot as well. I'm not good. In fact, I tried before, when I started writing this book, I tried for the first time mapping out a plot and writing it then. I threw away half a book that I did like that because it was dead to me. It was so dead. I can't, if I know what's supposed to happen, I can't write the scene because it doesn't get the energy into it. Yeah. So
I know exactly what you mean.
You know what I mean? Everyone's different. Yeah, everyone.
It's that energy of feeling like, you know, the work lives and breathes. It's like when you were reading it, it could have been a film. I mean, I was in it. It was like it lived off the page for me when you were, do you know what I mean? Like, in fact, that's a special quality. And, you know, I love work that does that. I just think it speaks to you on such a visceral level that you cannot help but respond to it. Like when you were when there's the line you said about his mustache not existing above it's so hilarious. It's so funny, but also so distinctive that, you know, when I read it, I was laughing. And then hearing you read it, I was laughing. I was like, oh my God. And it was just like Dali-esque as well, you know. Crazy Zadie Wells. I love it when work does that. So that's that was probably a really long answer to that question.
No, but it was half a PhD, but that's what the person was asking for.
Yeah.
Hey, we've got a question from Leonie Ross. Thank you so much for coming.
Leonie, thank you so much. Have your ears been burning, Leonie?
Can each writer imagine the inside of their own heads, how they experience their own minds, and choose one texture we could find there, one scent, one sound? You go first.
Yeah, I mean, maybe it has to be nudibranch. It has to be these mollocks that I've become sort of obsessed with. I feel like my brain is like that. You know, these creatures, and they're alien-like, and they're all so individual, and they're malleable, and they're slick, you know, and they're just like bright and colorful and vibrant. I feel like my headspace is like, that's why this collection had to be called Nudibranch, because that spoke to me on so many levels. It was like, these creatures are my kin. A weird way.
This answer is so much better than the answer I can come up with now. Honestly, this answer is better. My answer is rubbish, but it's simply the thing in my mind would be sunshine. There would be bright sunshine.
Amazing.
Yeah, my writing is also sometimes violent and sometimes brutal, and it has this realism to it. But in the writing, there's like this flooded sunshine and tons of space, like all of the stuff we don't get in London, I guess, or not.
I agree with that. There's a, I know what you're saying. There's a luminescence to your writing. It's luminous, you know, even though it will be graphic and violent, and there's something about it that is just bright and like searing, you know, searing.
Yeah, that's what I want. I want to. It's a searing place.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. You know, those are great questions.
Yeah, they're amazing questions.
Yeah, amazing. Trust Miss Leone Ross to ask that. Trust Leone to ask that question.
We need Leone's answer. Can you type it in the chat? But Lisa Blackman, what are you both working on at the moment? And can you give us a taste of your forthcoming project?
Oh.
What are you working on?
I'm working on a novel. I'm working on a novel, which I'm excited about. But I've also been working on commissions as well, like nonfiction stuff. And I haven't written loads of nonfiction, actually. So it's been interesting. You know, obviously I've written stuff for like The Guardian and spaces like that, but I wouldn't say that I was one of those writers who wrote loads and loads of nonfiction. So to do some nonfiction writing has challenged me actually in a different way, you know, because my immediate instinct is to write how I write fiction, but sometimes you can't do that depending on what the commission is. So, you know, you have to find other ways of doing the writing. And then sometimes I'm writing nonfiction and I'm like, oh, I really want to get back to writing fiction. But, you know, so it's a balance. It's that thing of being challenged. It's nice to be challenged in a different way. But yeah, the other thing is, yeah, working on the novel, which I'm excited about. But, you know, it's good to go back to that space because, yeah, last year was just such a difficult year, I think, for many of us, that it sort of threw you off kelter. Well, me off kelter. Yeah, because obviously I was sick as well. So, but yeah, it's nice to, how lucky are we, I guess, to have this creative space, you know,
really,
especially during this time, like to be able to make things. It's really special, even though for us, it's just like, oh yeah, it's just the way we think, you know.
it has been a bit of a blessing in this.
Yeah, you know, imagine if you didn't have that, what you you know, how would you cope with that, with what's been happening? So yeah, that's I think really important. I was gonna say to you, this whole pandemic period, has it affected you in terms of, I don't know, being being more sure of the things you want to focus on or write about, and you know, your intentions? Or is it just kind of business as usual for you? You know, you have a very strong identity and, you know, sense of what you're doing already.
Yeah, it's a good question.
Has it made you think, oh, there are other areas I want to explore? Do you know what I mean? Like, I talk to some people and they're like, oh, I've never really written, I've never really thought about writing novellas. And suddenly I wrote a novella during this period, and it's made me think about form in a different way. Do you know what I mean? So I just wondered.
Definitely. I mean, I think at the moment, I think I still don't quite have the measure of the impact that all of this is had or is having on me, all of this stuff. Yeah. I think we're going to be dealing with this stuff for years to come, probably.
Yeah.
But in terms of my writing, I don't think it's done much at all. I'm sort of really bloody minded and single minded in terms of my writing project. I kind of know what it is that I'm doing and what I want to do. So I think I'm just gonna, I mean, I'm also gonna try and write a new novel because that's what I do. Yeah, but it's kind of I think it's like more like what I said before. It hasn't changed much. I kind of know what my project is. And I just want to do it better and better and more ambitious and more ambitious.
That's sort amazing.
I guess I want to do. But I've also been writing little bits of them. I've also been writing commissions that were sort of half. I've had a commission from Freeze, you know, the art magazine that was non-fiction.
Oh, fantastic. Yes.
I turned it. It was like I turned the non-fiction into partly fiction. So they were open to like having like some hybrid, half part fictional, part speculative.
That's really cool.
It's a thing. So that was good fun.
It's lovely when you get commissions like that, actually, that, you know, you can, it still, you know, has your kind of authenticity and you can play around with it and do something fun with it. That's, you know, like you said, it's like blending fiction and nonfiction and doing something interesting. Yeah, that's quite fun. Yeah.
I think we're at the end of the hour. Are we sort of, have we got any more questions, or have we sort of addressed most of the questions that we have? I think we've got them all. Should we say thanks to everyone? Or I guess we should stick to the hour so that it's not like a massive video file by the end of it.
Yeah, for them to have to kind of process. Well, thanks everyone for their questions as well. Absolutely. Yeah, really interesting questions too.
Yeah, really interesting questions, guys. And thank you so much for coming and listening.
Yeah, thank
you. Thank you so much for reading.
Oh, it's a joy. It's a pleasure.
We've said thanks to everyone at the LRB as well, Claire and Anthony, and everybody who's selling our books there as well, Gail especially. I know that people are working on selling our work there, so really, really appreciate it.
Thanks for listening. To find out more about London Review Bookshop events, visit londonreviewbookshop.co.uk/events.